Literature and art were all as yet in their infancy or still unborn. The large array of cultures that were now under Arab rule meant that there were abundant raw materials available for the task, and the increasing number of converts provided willing hands to do the work. The Abbasid Revolution in 750 swept away the tight-knit Syro-Arabian elite and its obsession with tribal politics, and opened the doors to the cosmopolitan world of Iraq and East Iran Transoxania. The conditions were perfect for the reshaping of the cultural landscape. One might legitimately ask if it were inevitable that Islam would be a feature of this new world order, since around two-thirds of the revolutionaries in the Abbasid armies were natives of the lands formerly a part of the Persian Empire. Could they not have swept aside the religion that the Arabs had brought if they had chosen to do so? Yet it was in the name of Islam that they rebelled. The rapid downfall of the Sasanian dynasty must have convinced many in Persia that God was on the side of the Arabs and approved of their faith. Success is always a powerful argument. What the rebels wanted, therefore, was not to get rid of Islam, but to make it more responsive to their needs and more in tune with their culture, and to free it from the control of an alien ruling elite in Syria. Some of the native revolutionaries were only superficially Islamized, as we can see from the extreme actions of followers of the Rawandi sect, who acclaimed the Caliph Mansur as the Messiah and jumped naked or wearing silk garments from city walls in the expectation of the end of days. But there is no reason to doubt their original sincerity and their hope that through Islam they would achieve a better life. Zoroastrianism's stronghold had been in southwest Iran, which had been hit hard by the Arab conquerors and its noble families slaughtered or dispersed, whereas East Iran and Transoxania had been home to many religions. Islam, made attractive by its link to power and the elite, provided a common religious idiom for all the diverse groups of this multi-faith land. Moreover, unlike Zoroastrianism and Christianity, it had no institutionalized clergy or hierarchy, which meant that it was particularly open to newcomers, despite prejudice from some quarters of the Arab population. There were a number of insurrections by Zoroastrian groups, especially in the mountainous regions of Iran, but these were isolated affairs, and their failure only served to confirm that by the late 8th century, Islam was already too well established to be uprooted. Empire or Commonwealth? Another feature that one might have expected to endure, at least for a few centuries, was a single unified imperial government over all the lands that the Arabs had conquered, but in the end it proved to be ephemeral. The Umayyad dynasty, 661 to 750, did quite a good job, despite three civil wars, though of course they were as busy acquiring territory as governing it. The Abbasid dynasty that succeeded them, however, watched parts of the empire break away from day one of their rule. Spain was a direct casualty of the revolution, for some members of the Umayyad family fled there and made it their new home, and the implacable hostility of the Abbasid family toward them left them no choice but to secede. The Berber revolt in northwest Africa, though initially crushed, had set in motion an unstoppable exodus, and by the year 800, there were at least five autonomous dynasties in the region. A bloody civil war, 809 to 813, between the sons of the Caliph Harun al-Rashid, weakened Abbasid rule in Iran and enabled a number of different types of dynasties of local origin to flourish there. Only a short while afterward, the political fragmentation of the Arab Empire extended to the central lands, and in 945, Iraq itself was captured, first by Daylamis from northern Iran, who revived the Persian title Shah of Shahs, and then in 1055 by Turks from Central Asia, which heralded a long period of Turkish domination in the Middle East. Political unity was never to return, and the Muslim world remained a multipolar one forever thereafter. And yet the societies ruled by these petty dynasties did enjoy a broadly similar culture. We can speak of an Islamic commonwealth, or Islamdom, in the medieval Middle East, just as we can speak of a Christian commonwealth, or Christendom, in medieval Europe, that is, a loose amalgam of polities where Islam was the dominant, though not necessarily the majority, religion, and where the general way of life had a significant number of common features. The Muslim geographers who bravely traversed these lands from the 10th to the 15th century present a picture that, although exhibiting numerous local differences, has reassuringly recognizable outlines. Turkish soldiers, Jewish merchants, Christian doctors, the symbiotic triad of mosque, church, and synagogue, lively bazaars, a passion for poetry, Arabic religious texts, Persian epic history, and so on. Why, then, did a unitary Arab empire last such a short time in comparison to its predecessors? That is, why did it not enjoy the same sort of lifespan as the Roman Byzantine Empire, circa 830 years until the Arab conquests, or the Persian Empire, circa 1100 years? There are two main answers to this, one topographical, ecological, and the other ideological. The former is perhaps the most significant and can be put very simply. The Arab Empire was strung out over thousands of miles across deserts and mountains, which made communication and transportation slow and revolts at the margins difficult to contain. A similar problem afflicted many empires acquired in a rapid and relatively unplanned manner, such as that of the Turks, 552 to 630, and Mongols, 1206 to 1294. By contrast, the Roman Empire, acquired much more slowly, was organized around the Mediterranean Sea, which allowed comparatively fast and cheap transportation of goods and troops, and the Persian Empire, though less integrated, was still quite manageable, predicated on control of the rich Tigris-Euphrates river system in Iraq by the adjacent Iranian highland peoples. These two water systems, the Mediterranean and the Tigris-Euphrates, were, however, separated by the stony wastes of the Syrian desert, which greatly hampered the efforts of any one power to dominate both of them. Only the Achaemenid Persians and the Arabs ever managed it. Furthermore, a large proportion of the territory conquered by the Arabs consisted of marginal, arid lands, which had two potentially dangerous consequences. Their empire was particularly vulnerable to climatic fluctuations and over-exploitation, and also to the movements of the large populations of nomads who inhabited these lands, especially the Turk and Mongol tribes of the Great Eurasian Steppe. The so-called medieval warm period, for instance, which lasted from the 10th to the early 14th century, resulted in very volatile climatic conditions in Central Asia, including persistent droughts and cold winters, and prompted the migration of some of these steppe tribes into the eastern part of the Arab Empire, and their gradual usurpation of political power. Inhospitable terrain also impeded internal conquest. For the whole of the Umayyad period, the inhabitants of pretty much every upland region within the lands claimed by the Arab regime maintained a high degree of autonomy. Some did so officially, acknowledged as vassals of the Arabs and accorded a treaty. In this position were the Armenians, Georgians, Albanians, and various peoples of the Caspian region. Many did so unofficially, such as the Berbers of the Atlas and Aures Mountains, and the Kurds and other peoples of the eastern Taurus, northern Zagros range in modern southeast Turkey and northwest Iran. This unofficial category we only tend to hear about when they came into conflict with the Arabs. For example, in 751, the Arabs of Meferkat in northern Mesopotamia rose up against Abbasid rule and caused many problems for the people in the surrounding area. Those in the mountains organized their own militia under a local Christian named John, son of Daddi. From this point on, evils increased between the people of the mountains and the Arabs, for they committed murder against each other every day without end. The people of the mountains seized all the passes. Not one Arab was seen in the whole mountain region. Soon the affair spread, and we hear of Armenians and Urartians, from the area around Lake Van, fomenting trouble in this region. The mountains of the Middle East continued to harbor distinctive, tight-knit communities, fiercely attached to their identities and native lands, and it was principally in the cities of the fertile lowlands that the Arabs held sway. But of course, it was in these cities that mainstream culture flourished, and so even when desert and mountain peoples succeeded not just in holding their own, but also in conquering the lowlands, they were not able to impress much of their own culture upon Islamic civilization. The second answer to the question of why the Arabs failed to maintain durable political unity concerns ideology. In effect, Islam itself became hostile to an imperial style of government, but that, of course, only raises the question of why it developed in that direction. Jesus had said that his kingdom was not of this world, but that did not stop Eusebius, bishop of Caesarea, from happily endorsing Constantine the Great as a Christian emperor upon the latter's conversion in AD 312 and drawing up a theoretical blueprint for Christian imperialism. The Quran, though it offers no detailed instructions on how to govern, does insist on obedience to those in authority. Ulil Amr, and these and similar injunctions could easily have been used in support of an Islamic imperialism. Certainly, Umayyad dynasts seemed willing to emulate the emperors of old, as we can see from a fresco in Walid II's palace of Qusair Amra that portrays him receiving homage from past and present world leaders, and from a poem of Yazid III that boasts of his kinship ties to the Persian, Byzantine, and Turkish royal families. It was not to be, however, and there are two main reasons for this. First, since Islam, unlike Christianity, had no clergy, especially before the introduction of madrasas in the 11th century, there was no hierarchy of religious staff to offer ideological support for an imperial Islamic rule in return for political and financial backing. The men who began to lay the foundations of Islamic law in the 8th century were amateurs, either independently wealthy or pursuing their studies alongside their main occupation. They were mostly outside the political establishment, and so tended to put into their writings an idealized portrayal of what government should be. This can be seen in their characterization of the Caliph Umar I, the model statesman, who is presented as virulently opposed to the accumulation of wealth and power by the state. The only persons who did recommend a more imperial style of rule were senior administrators, but they did not have the moral authority to make it a part of Islam. One of their number, Ibn al-Muqaffa, died 757, did devise a blueprint for an imperial form of Islamic government, and it is telling that he was executed by the Abbasid Caliph Mansur in striking contrast to Eusebius, who was personally honored by the Emperor Constantine. Second, many of the participants in the early Arab conquests were nomads, and they had a nomad attitude toward the spoils of conquest, namely, that they should be redistributed to all directly and not accumulated by the state for apportionment at a later date. You have appropriated our spoils, fey, is the most common accusation of rebels against the government throughout the Umayyad period, and equal distribution of the spoils is the most common pledge of revolutionaries to their followers. Soldiers were paid stipends by the state from the tax revenues that it had collected, but that meant they were dependent on the state, which added to their sense of grievance and made them more determined to reduce the power of the central government so that it could not filch what they felt was due to the rank and file. Arguments over who was entitled to what were legion, and changes to the system were very difficult to implement. The extreme concentration of power in the hands of a single clan, Umayyads and then Abbasids, from just one tribe, Quraysh, also exacerbated the situation. In short, a fair proportion of the soldiery of the early Arab army was disgruntled by the center's monopoly of wealth and power and did all they could to constrain an imperial style of government. Their attitude evidently fed into the idealized image of Umar I as a Bedouin hero. He wears rough animal hair clothes, prefers his camel to a horse, is fiercely opposed to affected manners and ostentatious displays of wealth, and favors a simple and austere life over the fineries and fripperies of empire. Arab Islam or Gentile Islam. Whatever the exact reason, Arab rule over all the conquered land lasted only about 100 years, circa 640s to 740s, and Arab control of the central portion of their realm for about 300 years, circa 640s to 940s. Yet in this short time, the Arabs were able to set in motion two processes that helped to offset their political fragmentation: Arabization and Islamization. These faced limits to their progress, and they happened much more slowly than is usually assumed, but there is no doubt that they were wildly successful even if there were compromises along the way. They tend to be regarded as one-way processes, the conquerors imposing their identity and religion on the conquered, but in reality, the conquered were fully involved, especially those who converted to Islam, whose contribution was crucial. Arabization has two aspects to it that are closely related: language and identity. Many of the conquerors spoke a dialect of Arabic as their native tongue, and it had also been used by at least some of the tribes allied to Byzantium and Persia for their own internal administrative purposes in the century or so before the Arab conquests. It is not surprising, then, that the Arabs employed Arabic for certain bureaucratic purposes from the very beginning of their occupation. For the first few decades, local languages continued to be used alongside Arabic, but in the 690s, the Caliph Abd al-Malik, wishing to integrate better the former Persian and Byzantine realms, ordered that Arabic be the sole official language of the government offices. This policy took some time to come into effect, but by the mid-8th century it was fully in place, and thereafter, if one wanted a good administrative job, it was essential to be well-versed in Arabic. Historians of medieval Europe are often surprised by this success, for the Germanic invaders of the West Roman Empire all ended up learning Latin rather than imposing Gothic. In part, the difference is that the Arabs were more linguistically homogeneous than the Germanic tribes and possessed a holy scripture in Arabic. But there is also the practical point that the Arabs acquired not just one empire, but all of one, Persia, and part of another, Byzantium. This meant that they had to deal with not just one imperial language, but at least two, Persian and Greek, as well as a whole host of very different regional languages, a situation that cried out for a lingua franca. The pre-conquest languages of the Middle East had different fates. The lands that lay on the edges of the empire, but that avoided direct conquest by the Arabs, retained their languages, and in many cases they are still spoken today, even if by substantially fewer people. Armenian, Georgian, Caucasian Albanian, spoken by the Udi people of modern Azerbaijan, Nubian, spoken by some tribes in modern Sudan, and various languages of the Hindu Kush region, for example, Pashto. Within the Arab Empire, language survival was determined by a number of factors, the most important of which was the geography, environment of the area where the language was spoken. In mountain ranges and deserts, they could survive more easily, as was the case with the Kurdish and Berber languages, whereas in the Nile Valley of Egypt and along the coastal plains of North Africa, there was nowhere to hide, and their two languages, Coptic, Egypt, and Latin, North Africa, had already lost considerable ground to Arabic by the 11th century and dwindled fast thereafter. A second major factor was the degree to which a linguistic community maintained its traditions and elites intacted in the course of the conquests and subsequent political changes. In the difficult terrain of eastern Iran and Transoxania, local potentates had been able to bargain with the invaders to preserve their autonomy. Since they had a political tradition as well as a historical, cultural one, they were also able to take advantage of the weakness at the center of the Arab Empire in the 9th century to establish their own independent dynasties, which permitted the use of the Persian language not only in speech, but also, crucially, in writing. Whereas the Islamic religious tradition came to be inimical to imperial government, Persian literature celebrated it, remembering the great days of the Sasanian emperors, and for this reason it was enthusiastically adopted by various imperial rulers in the East, such as the Mongols of Iran, 1258 to 1335, the Timurids of Central Asia, 1370 to 1501, and the Mughals of India, 1526 to 1757, who also all used Persian for their administration. The language was then taken up by the Safavids, 1501 to 1736, who made it the official tongue of the whole of Iran, as well as making Shi'ism the official form of Islam in their realm. One might have expected the same thing to happen in North Africa, where independent Berber dynasties emerged. However, they had no imperial tradition of their own to fall back on, and so they based the legitimacy of their rule on strict adherence to Sunni Islam. This, plus the reliance of their economies on international trade, linked them with the central Islamic lands and favored the primacy of Arabic in their dominions. The Atlas and Kabyle Mountains and the Sahara Desert. The Atlas and Kabyle Mountains and the Sahara Desert, which were unattractive to outsiders, and where its speakers were locked into close communities, some of them adhering to different versions of Islam, such as Kharijism. A third factor is the level and manner of immigration of native speakers of the politically dominant language. Large numbers of Arab troops were stationed in the garrisons of Basra and Kufa in Iraq and Fustat in Egypt, and many more settled in and around the cities of Damascus, Homs, and Aleppo, where Arabophone tribes had already been a familiar sight before Islam. Soon, new cities were built, either for troops, like Mosul and Wasit, or for civilians, like Aqaba and Ramla. Even if not all who came to live in these centers knew Arabic when they arrived, they soon learned it, for there it was the language of power and everyday communication. By contrast, fewer Arabs settled in Iran and Transoxania, and they were dispersed among the population, taking up residence in pre-existing cities rather than in newly constructed garrisons. This meant that over time, the Arabs usually became Persian speakers instead of the Persians becoming Arabic speakers. For religious matters, it remained important to know Arabic, but at the everyday level and for subjects like literature and history, Persian was preferred. As the scholar who translated an Arabic history of Bukhara into Persian in 1128 observed, most people in Transoxania show no desire to read an Arabic book. The large concentrations of Arabic speakers in Syria and Iraq quite soon had an impact upon the two main languages of the region, Greek and Aramaic. Greek was worst affected, since it was mainly spoken only in the cities and plains, and so had no ecological niche in which to entrench itself, and a moderate proportion of the Greek-speaking elite had fled to Byzantium in the course of the Arab conquests. In addition, Greek's appeal came from being a lingua franca and the language of a powerful empire, but Arabic fulfilled these two functions much better than Greek by the 8th century, and by around AD 800, Greek had ceased to operate as a major language of the Levant and Egypt. Aramaic fared much better, because it was the language of a number of discrete socio-religious communities that had learned how to organize themselves for survival in the period before the Arab conquests, such as the Mandaeans of southern Iraq and the various anti-Chalcedonian Christian communities of Syria, Iraq, and the Jazeera. Some of these had the added advantage of living in mountainous areas, where even today they cling on, in modern Lebanon, southeast Turkey, and northern Iraq. But since these Aramaic speakers had no experience of self-rule in the period before the Arab conquests, having been under the sway of Byzantium and Persia for centuries, it was never likely that they would manage to form their own independent dynasties like the Persians and Berbers. This meant that in the long term, their numbers were set to dwindle, given the deleterious effects of enduring inferior status. Once Arabic had risen to the status of a lingua franca for the whole Arab Empire, it became used not only for administration and the military, but also for law, theology, literature, and science. This helped to bring about a cultural boom in the 9th century, as numerous Greek, Persian, Syriac, and Sanskrit texts were translated into Arabic, studied, and made a part of the intellectual worldview of Islamic civilization. Despite this international input, Islam itself retained a strong Arab imprint, and this brings us to the second aspect of Arabization, namely, the imposition of Arab identity, the assumption of an Arab name, the acceptance of Arabian history as the fount of Islamic origins and of the superiority of Arab ancestry to any other. Some non-Arab elites, especially from the lands of the former Persian Empire, disliked this heavy Arab stamp and called for a more open and cosmopolitan Islam. This was not a clash between ethnic groups, though it is often portrayed in our sources in terms of Arabs versus Persians, principally because those were the two main cultural models on offer. Few of those who supported the Arab side and wrote books about Arab culture and history were themselves ethnically Arab. For example, probably the greatest expert on Arabian history was Abu Ubaidah, died 825, grandson of a Persian Jew, and one of the most vocal opponents of a Gentile Islam was Ibn Qutayba, died 889, descendant of a Persian family from Khorasan. The question was rather whether one supported a narrow Arab focus for Islam, the Arab party, or a more cosmopolitan focus, which was open to alien wisdom and values, the Gentile party. In modern terms, it was a debate over cultural orientation, how multicultural Islam should be. Those favoring a Gentile or multicultural Islam, called Shurubis, which like Gentiles is the adjective from peoples, pointed out that all the marvels of history, scientific inventions, monumental buildings, great works of literature, and so on, had been accomplished by non-Arabs, and all the famous persons of history were non-Arabs, and so Islam should celebrate all these characters and achievements and not stay fixated on the pre-Islamic Arabian past. In a sense, both sides won, or at least they both got something of what they wanted. The fact that the Quran was revealed in Arabic and that Islam was preached by an Arab prophet in Arabia was a strong argument in favor of retaining the Arab focus. Moreover, the whole legal system, Sharia, rested on knowledge of the Arabic Quran and the Arabic sayings of Muhammad, and those scholars who had invested so much effort into acquiring this knowledge and derived status and income from it were unwilling to accept the validity of any other legal system in any other language. Yet it became acceptable to recite the Quran and write works of Islamic scholarship in languages other than Arabic, to adopt foreign styles of aesthetic representation and storytelling, to recount the past glories of non-Arab civilizations, and so on. This situation accelerated with the rise of non-Arab dynasties. Many of these, in order to mark their difference and independence from the Arab regime, played up their own culture and celebrated it in their own language. The rulers of the various breakaway states of Iran and Transoxania, for example, often claimed descent from Sasanian emperors and magnates, which was a way of reinforcing their own legitimacy, of maintaining some distinctiveness from their Arab Muslim neighbors to the west, and of tapping into an imperial tradition that was still widely recognized and revered. They played up the exploits and cultural achievements of their alleged noble ancestors, and they patronized Persian poetry, history writing, and figural representation. The Arab imprint upon Islam was, therefore, gradually weakened over time, especially after Turkish groups had taken charge of pretty much all the eastern portions of the Arab Empire, and after Islam had spread to ever more distant lands. Yet even now, many Muslims will want to go on pilgrimage to Arabia, learn some Arabic, and give their children Arab names. Islam ended up, then, as something of a hybrid religion. It did not lose totally its attachment to the ethnic identity of its founding fathers, as did Christianity and Buddhism, but equally it did not manage to elevate the identity and language of these founding fathers to an exclusive status, as did Judaism, Jews and Hebrew, Hinduism, Hindus and Sanskrit, and Zoroastrianism, Iranians and Persian. The fact, however, that this Arab focus endured so well indicates that it must have been an important aspect of the identity of the prime movers and shakers guiding the initial conquests. The ingredients of Islamic civilization. The second process initiated by the Arabs was Islamization. Again, this consisted of two parts, the spread of the religion of Islam and the evolution and dissemination of a distinctively Islamic way of doing things, not just in the field of religion, but also in art, literature, politics, and so on. Western scholars have tended to focus heavily on the religious dimension, especially in recent times, so much so that we use the term Islam for both the religion and the civilization, as though they are the same thing. Certainly the religion of Islam was a major part of Islamic civilization, but it was never all there was to it, and non-Muslims, though they could not contribute to Islamic religion, except as examples of what behavior and thinking to avoid, did play a major part in the development of Islamic civilization. They formed the majority of the population of the Middle East for at least the first 3 centuries after the death of Muhammad, and their status within the Arab Empire as protected peoples was part and parcel of what became Islamic civilization, distinguishing it from medieval Christendom, which offered no such legal protection. This enabled Christians and Jews to make a substantial contribution to the intellectual life of the Islamic world, as we can see from the lists of scholars active in medieval times in cosmopolitan cities like Baghdad, Aleppo, Cairo, and Cordoba. In a general way, the ingredients for Islamic civilization derived from the conquerors, hailing from Arabia, and from the conquered. Some modern scholars regard Arabia as having been cut off from the wider world in pre-Islamic times, and so principally look for these ingredients in the cultures of the late antique settled Middle East: Islamic philosophy in Neoplatonic thought, Islamic law in Rabbinic Judaism, Islamic ethics and statecraft in Sasanian Persia, Islamic theology in Byzantine Christianity, and so on. Others believe Arabia, precisely because it was cut off from the mainstream, preserved ancient Middle Eastern traditions, or they accept the view of medieval Muslim sources that most elements of Islamic civilization go back to Muhammad and the caliphs of Medina, and they hunt for these ingredients in pre-Islamic Arabian custom and lore. The truth is probably somewhere in between, but pre-Islamic Arabia was never culturally uniform, and it was not as isolated as is usually supposed. The South maintained maritime relations with India and the Mediterranean world, and its northwest and northeast sectors had long been in contact with the frontier zones of the complex societies of the Levant and Iraq. And in these zones, hybrid cultures arose that blended imperial and local traditions, as we can see from the Quran, where well-known biblical stories about miscreants and prophets are told with a local spin. By what mechanisms did these ingredients make their way into the newly emerging civilization? Converts are likely to have been instrumental, for they acted as conduits between two worlds, especially as many in the early period were prisoners of war, who often originated in a very different place from where they ended up. Shared environment is also important, for in the early centuries, and especially in the big cities, people of very different geographical, cultural, and religious affiliations lived in close proximity. Separate quarters for different confessional groups only came much later, and the Arabs themselves did not differentiate between non-Muslims, as the 7th century monk John of Fenwick notes with disapproval. There was no distinction between pagan and Christian. The believer was not known from a Jew. Such interconfessional mixing was especially common in the bustling, heterogeneous garrison cities of the new rulers, where one was exposed to contact with persons of very diverse origin, creed, and status. In addition, there were the widespread phenomena of mixed marriages and reciprocal festival attendance, of commercial contacts and public debate, all of which promoted the circulation of ideas and information. As regards who contributed what, the broad answer is that contributions came from a multitude of sources, for the early Muslim community quickly became a very pluralist one. To cite John of Fenwick again, the Arab armies went annually to distant parts and to the islands and brought back captives from all the peoples under the heavens. However, it is very noticeable when one looks at the origins of converts who became religious authorities or administrators that a high proportion of them were from the former territories of the Persian Empire and from Transoxania. In part, this is because the population of the former Byzantine provinces converted to Islam much more slowly than that of the eastern half of the caliphate, where the total collapse of the Persian Empire left no prospect of a revival of the old regime. And in part, it reflects the survival in East Iran and Transoxania of highly literate elites who had the ability and motivation to become senior bureaucrats and scholars. Good examples are the Barmakids, formerly Buddhist leaders from Balkh, and the Sahlids, originally Zoroastrian nobles from Sarachs, whose families dominated the top jobs in the Abbasid administration in the late 8th and early 9th centuries. Such persons, once the seat of government had moved to Baghdad, a stone's throw away from the former Persian capital, oversaw a large-scale Persianization of Islamic culture, especially in such areas as literature, history, and art. Moreover, it was safe to emulate, even idealize, Sasanian Persian emperors because their rule had been extinguished, in contrast to Byzantine emperors who represented an enemy power and so could not serve as models. For example, the Caliph Mansur imitated Khusro I in initiating a program of translating foreign scholarship, though Mansur outdid him in the volume and breadth of the works translated, and there was a great appetite for works on Persian statecraft and court etiquette, especially among the secretarial class, who were often criticized for preferring such literature to Islamic texts. A 9th-century satirist, for example, caricatured the novice scribe, saying that he enthusiastically learns the maxims of Buzurg Mihr, chief minister of Khusro I, the testament of Emperor Ardashir on good government, the epistles on how to be a good secretary, of Abd al-Hamid and the wisdom literature of Ibn al-Muqaffa, two mid-8th-century bureaucrats. But if anyone in his presence mentions the Quran or the Prophet, he grimaces and interrupts the conversation to speak of the admirable way the country was run under the Persians. One aspect of Persia that was more difficult to insert into Islam was its religious thought, for it was quite alien to the monotheist traditions of the Near East. Yet given its richness, distinctiveness, and antiquity, it was inevitable that its adherents would make efforts to preserve at least some of its components within Islam. This happened in particular through Shiism and Sufism, Islamic mysticism. Unlike Sunni Islam, which gave preference to book-based knowledge with only limited interpretative powers allowed to scholars, Shiism and Sufism granted a substantial role in the elaboration of Islam to living guides with direct access to God. In the case of Shiism, this meant imams and their intermediaries, and in Sufism, this role was diffused among numerous gurus and teachers. This flexibility meant that such figures could adapt easily to local conditions and ways of thought, and this facilitated the evolution of a distinctively Persian strain of Sufism. One of its key features is the notion of universal manifestation. The divine is everywhere, in rocks and trees, as well as humans and animals, and Sufi-minded poets would speak of their divine beloved as pervading existence, appearing in white and black, in Christians and Jews, in dogs and cats. Another is reincarnation, both the idea that humans return in different forms according to how virtuous they were in their previous life, and the belief that the spirit might migrate from person to person. Again, this could take a poetic form, as in the verse attributed to Rumi, that his beloved appears in different garb, sometimes old and sometimes young, as Noah, Abraham, Joseph, Moses, Jesus, in the image of Muhammad, and as the sword of Ali. Sufism preached that the truth did not lie in external rules and fixed conventions, but in hidden meanings and shifting forms, and this flexibility and ambiguity, coupled with a loose organizational structure, made it an attractive receptacle for the Persian religious tradition. And though it was suffused with beliefs from many other traditions similarly seeking a home, the input from Iran constituted perhaps the richest contribution. Though a few of the more extreme Sufis rejected all law as mere earthly shackles, the majority, not wanting to exclude themselves from mainstream Islam, accepted it as necessary for the duration of a human's lifetime. This was essential, for Islamic law, Sharia, came to be a defining feature of Islamic civilization. Its structural similarity with Judaism, a comprehensive religio-legal system regulated by scholars on the basis of scripture and oral tradition from a prophet, betrays its origins in early Abbasid Iraq, where Muslim lawyers enjoyed close and sustained contact with the region's large and prosperous Jewish community. Jurisprudential theory, which stressed four principal sources, scripture, practice, of the prophet in the case of Islam, analogy and consensus, could be Roman, Judaic, or derive more broadly from the late antique Middle East. But where did the raw material for the individual laws come from? They give the appearance of having all originated in Muhammad's Arabia, since they are traced back via a chain of transmitters to Muhammad himself. This is the view put out by Muslim scholars, namely that the Arab conquerors brought with them from West Arabia a fully formed body of law that was different from that current in the rest of the Middle East and made it the new law of the Muslims, and many modern Islamicists accept this picture without demur. However, Arabia had been in contact with the rest of the Middle East for millennia, and in any case, legal systems are highly resistant to rapid change. The laws that were in place in the Middle East the day before the Arab conquests were still in use the day after, and this pre-existing corpus of laws, a mixture of ancient Middle Eastern and Roman law, remained current in the Umayyad period, supplemented by ad hoc emendations made by caliphs and their agents. Starting in the early 8th century, though, an emerging body of Muslim scholars began working through this ancient corpus and accepted, rejected, or modified its rulings, giving those that they endorsed a done and or said by Muhammad stamp, which lent old practices the appearance of being new Islamic ones from Arabia. For example, two 6th century documents on papyrus from Petra and Nisana in Byzantine Arabia record the division of an inheritance by the drawing of lots, as opposed to applying a set of preordained rules. If we turn to collections of Muhammad's sayings, we find it written there that Muhammad was once approached by two men who disagreed about an inheritance, and he told them to cast lots and to accept whatever result this yielded. Whether Muhammad had this encounter or not does not really matter. The point is that this pre-Islamic practice, which may well have been current in pre-Islamic West Arabia, now had the prophetic seal of approval and could rightfully take its place in the vast edifice of Islamic law. The point being made here is not that Islam borrowed from or was influenced by ancient Middle Eastern and Roman law, but that this corpus of law remained current after the Arab conquests and was taken over and reworked by Muslim scholars. Thus, many rulings that we think of as very Islamic, like amputation of the hand for theft and the death penalty for apostates, were applied in the region long before Islam. Some of these items were maintained, while others, such as the adoption of children and contracts involving earnest money, non-refundable deposits, were rejected. In both cases, the acceptances and rejections were attributed to Muhammad himself. This process was carried out by a large number of religious authorities in different centers of the Arab Empire at a furious pace, and already by the mid-9th century, a number of collections of the sayings and deeds of Muhammad had been compiled, including the celebrated volumes of Bukhari, died 870, and Muslim, died 875. There one could find rulings on most aspects of everyday life, marriage and divorce, prayer and ablutions, relations between Muslims and non-Muslims, contracts and partnerships, waging war and concluding treaties, menstruation and shaving, meritorious and criminal actions. This did not set the law in stone. New sayings and or deeds were added, and judges used analytical reasoning to develop new rulings, fatwas, by analogy with existing rulings. But with the emergence of these collections, one could speak of a tangibly Islamic way of doing things, and so they contributed to the Islamicization of the lands conquered by the Arabs. Since many items in these collections were formed from the customs and practices of the pre-Islamic Middle East, we should not see this process as the imposition of an alien legal corpus, but as the consensual construction of a body of law by the new Muslim community, a majority of whom were from the ranks of the conquered peoples. Some features of Islamic civilization did not derive from adoption of existing ideas, but arose in reaction to them. Converts to Islam very often wanted to draw a line between themselves and their former co-religionists, and if they attained a position of religious authority, they would commonly encourage their Muslim followers to dissociate themselves from Christian, Jewish, and Zoroastrian practices. An interesting example is that of images. The Quran makes no mention of them, presumably because it was not really an issue in the relatively poor settlements of West Arabia. But in the rich cities of the Byzantine and Persian empires, they were everywhere, on frescoes, mosaics, manuscripts, buildings, rock faces, metal bowls, textiles, and so on. When Abd al-Malik sought to unify the currency of his realm, he initially followed the standard custom of placing his image as the ruler on the new coins. But a couple of years later, he withdrew this type and minted coins with no images on them, bearing only words, principally the Muslim creed and a couple of quotations from the Quran. No explanation is given, though not long afterward, sayings attributed to Muhammad expressing disapproval of images began to circulate. Since it only affected the display of images in public spaces, they remained common in private settings, especially in elite residences, it seems likely that it was a reaction to the profusion of images that could be seen on non-Muslim artifacts and constructions, and was regarded as a very dramatic way of illustrating the difference between Muslims and non-Muslims in the field of public art. The new policy had the unintended consequence of stimulating geometric styles of representation and calligraphy, which are art forms that we think of as very Islamic today. Thus, an apparently negative decision ended up by promoting what came to be seen as an Islamic aesthetic, and Islamicizing the public space of the conquered lands. Besides elaborating a system of Islamic law, Muslim scholars also embarked upon the Islamicization of history. For the pre-Islamic period, this meant linking biblical monotheist tradition with Arabia, which was accomplished by having Ishmael travel to Mecca with his father Abraham, build the Muslim sanctuary, Kaaba, there, and become the progenitor of the Arab people by marrying into the Arabian tribe of Jurhum. In addition, certain key human figures, like Aristotle, Alexander the Great, and Jesus, were repackaged as visionary Muslim monotheists. For the Islamic period, it meant portraying the birth of Muhammad's community as the dawn of a new age, marked concretely by the inauguration of a new calendar, AH1 equals AD 622, and morally by the transition from ignorance and barbarism, jahl, to knowledge, ilm, and truth, haq. This new dispensation was anchored in the Quran, which Muhammad had received from God, and it was spread far and wide by the Arab conquests, which were presented as having been orchestrated by God, leading to the establishment of God's rule, Hukm Allah. One blot on this otherwise idyllic picture was the unseemly behavior of Muhammad's companions, who squabbled and fought one another, most obviously in the First Civil War, 656 to 661. This was a problem for Islamic law, for it was the companions of Muhammad who had passed on his teachings and legal decisions to the next generation and the wider world, and one, therefore, needed to know that they could be relied upon to have transmitted this material correctly and carefully. They were, therefore, given a makeover, sanctified by recourse to late antique hagiographical techniques, and all came out as models of piety and beyond reproach, headed by the four rightly guided caliphs, Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali. Finally, the religious scholars sought to protect their own status as the guardians of the law by closing the door to any other would-be legislators, in particular the rulers, who had themselves legislated in the past or appointed others to do so for them. The scholars achieved this by positing that only the first four caliphs had the power to legislate, making the period when they ruled, 632 to 660, into a golden age when Islam was perfected and its norms properly practiced and implemented. It is a measure of the success of these scholars that still today it is their Islamicized version of history that is taught in schools and colleges around the world, in non-Muslim as well as Muslim countries. Conclusion. One of the aims of this book has been to peel away these Islamicizing layers in order to understand better the factors that underlay the success of the Arab conquests and the transformative impact that they had on the political, social, and cultural makeup of the Middle East. In the first place, we have seen that the most commented upon aspect of the conquests, their rapidity, is a consequence of the drive by the conquest leadership to recruit nomads into their armies. Nomads are much more mobile than sedentary people, more used to fighting in their everyday lives, and their work, herding animals, is less labor-intensive than growing crops, so more of them can be spared to fight than in an agricultural society. Nomad conquests tend, therefore, to have an explosive character, and this is most dramatically illustrated by the Mongol conquests, which led to the establishment, in just over 70 years, of the biggest empire of pre-modern times. In the Arab case, non-Muslim sources allow us to perceive an additional advantage, namely, that Arabs had been serving in the armies of Byzantium and Persia long before Islam. They had acquired valuable training in the weaponry and military tactics of the empires, and had become, to some degree, acculturated to their ways. In fact, these sources hint that we should view many in Muhammad's West Arabian coalition, its settled members as well as its nomads, not so much as outsiders seeking to despoil the empires, but as insiders trying to grab a share of the wealth of their imperial masters. In the second place, I have stressed that the Arab conquerors made heavy use of non-military means to extend and entrench their gains. As well as the usual promises to respect life, property, and freedom of worship to those who submitted without a fight, they offered tax exemptions and autonomy to those who lived in difficult terrain and who were willing to provide military service or to act as guides, spies, and informers. They also enrolled groups who showed themselves to be skilled in warfare and agreed to pay them stipends. This was, of course, a sound policy for any aspiring empire and adopted by many in the past. Around 80% of the soldiers in the British Imperial Army in India were natives of the subcontinent. Men of British origin were mainly found only in senior positions. Empires would also move conquered subjects around and deploy them far from their homeland, since they would then have no local sympathies. For example, garrisons in French Algeria were frequently composed, according to an American observer of 1922, of Negro troops in French uniform under the French flag and commanded by French officers. These sorts of policies were practiced by the Arabs too, but it is somewhat obscured by the fact that converts to Islam took Arab names and learned to speak Arabic, making the Arab armies look more homogeneous than they actually were. In reality, it was only by large-scale recruitment of non-Arabs in their armies that the Arabs could maintain their hold over their vast territories. Third, there is the role of Islam. Whereas a number of recent studies have emphasized the zeal that it imparted to the conquerors, I have preferred to focus on its integrative capacity, which allowed the conquerors and conquered to come together to create a new identity and a new civilization. Islam, as outlined in the Quran, would have been reassuringly familiar to Middle Easterners, drawing on the standard constituents of Abrahamic monotheism: one omnipotent God, prophets, scripture, prayer, fasting, almsgiving, pilgrimage, holy days, congregational buildings, and so on. It was different enough from Christianity and Judaism to make it distinctive, but similar enough to make it palatable, and the lack of any clergy or hierarchy made it particularly easy to convert to. In terms of faith, at least, all believers are equal before God. In this respect, the Arabs were very different from the Mongols. All that Genghis Khan's chiefs had to offer was worship of the sky god Tengri, and this cult was just too alien for the Mongols' new subjects to consider converting to, even if the Mongols had been willing to let them do so. Consequently, Mongol leaders mostly adopted one of the religions of the conquered peoples, which limited the degree to which they could instigate major cultural change. It is clear why some of the conquered would want to convert to Islam, since it facilitated access to all the benefits that the conquerors enjoyed. What is less evident is why the Arabs would let them do so. Conquerors do not normally grant entry to their ranks so easily, for they want to keep the privileges of conquest for themselves. European imperial powers, for example, were very restrictive. The Romans were much less so, but it was still some 400 years before they extended citizenship to everyone in their realm. There are hints that the Arabs favored a genealogical restriction, for example, blocking marriage between Arabs and non-Arabs, but they unwittingly found themselves in a Trojan horse scenario. They brought back such huge numbers of captives from their raids into their homes and government offices that it was difficult to keep them separate, especially once they started converting to Islam. Moreover, the right of Muslim males to marry four women and have numerous concubines, coupled with access to money and power, meant that on average, they fathered many more children than non-Muslims, and their political dominance ensured that these children were raised as Muslims. Some Arab governors did reject the conversions of low-status people, but given the lack of any support for such a policy in the Quran or the sayings of Muhammad, it was difficult to defend as a principle and faced strong opposition from those who felt that the spread of Islam was God's wish and strengthened Arab rule. One Muslim authority advocated the killing of 9 out of 10 non-Arab captives, but that was hardly a realistic option. In short, the combination of the ease of conversion to Islam and the numerousness of displaced prisoners of war willing to convert resulted in the rapid incubation of a Muslim population and ultimately of Islamic civilization. But if Islam was just a version of Abrahamic monotheism, like Judaism and Christianity, why did Islamic civilization diverge so much from Roman Christian civilization? A major part of the answer is that the Arabs not only captured large chunks of the Byzantine Empire, but also the entirety of the Persian Empire. The Arabs were, therefore, not only heirs to Rome, as has been highlighted by a number of recent studies, but also heirs to Persia. In the former Byzantine province of Syria, Islam had a close affinity to Christianity. Muslims were debating classic Christian questions like the relationship between free will and predetermination, the link between miracles and prophecy, and the ontological status of God's attributes. If they had only conquered Syria and Egypt, the Arabs would probably have partially assimilated to Byzantium in the same way that various Gothic and Frankish polities modeled themselves on the West Roman Empire, especially as many in the upper echelons of the Umayyad elite were descendants of Arab Christian tribesmen who had been citizens or allies of Byzantium. But the Arabs had swallowed the Persian Empire whole, and so, unsurprisingly, its culture was to have a huge impact on the nascent Arab polity. In particular, when the Arabs moved their capital to Iraq in AD 750, they were exposed to the full cultural weight of this realm. From Basra to Balkh, the grandsons of the aristocrats and bureaucrats of late Sasanian Persia were waiting in the wings to impart this cultural wealth to their new masters. Under their direction, the provincial minimalism of Umayyad Damascus was upgraded to the imperial grandeur of Abbasid Baghdad. In addition, an infusion of scholarship from ancient Greek texts translated into Arabic and the input from talented persons from all over the conquered territories, from Seville to Samarkand, transformed the Arabs' local Abrahamic cult from West Arabia into a world religion and the centerpiece of a thriving new civilization. Postscript. In the Quran, jihad means struggle, not only military struggle, but also moral struggle, struggle of the self, as it would be called later. Inevitably, it was the idea of military struggle that was to the fore while the conquests were in full swing. But as these waned, the Pacific notion gained ground, the struggle to act in accordance with God's laws and to build a just society. This has been In God's Path, the Arab Conquests and the Creation of an Islamic Empire, written by Robert G. Hoyland.